to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
You may have heard the name Scott Huber when he served on the school board or Chico City Council, but he has also served as president of his local Audubon chapter. He worked as a ranger, wildlife tour guide, real estate agent, solar energy consultant, and advertising account executive. For his latest book, Scott Huber also drew on his knowledge gained from his hobbies, including birding, hunting, fishing, hiking, and sailing. Since publishing his NorCal Naturalist Journal and Calendar in 2014, he's been working on his first novel, a post-apocalyptic wilderness survival tale. It's called After the Virus, a Survivalist's Journal. It's set in the nearby Ishi Wilderness, Lassen Volcanic National Park, Lake Almanor, and the Sacramento River. Scott Huber, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy.
You know, it looks like you took your own advice with this second book, because in your first book, you encouraged your reader to keep a journal. And that's the format of this second book, that you have a narrator named Will, write this journal. And I thought, well, you know, it sounds like this could be Scott. Is your first name William?
Yes, it is.
And that's how you named your protagonist, Will.
Not terribly creative.
But when I was reading it, I was visualizing you as this character. And one reason for that is the cover of the book. That's you in the photograph on the cover, is it not?
Yes, it is. Yes, that's...
And let's give your son, Liam, credit for that, the design of your cover. Why don't you describe what Liam did?
Sure. We know of a number of canyons that are fairly nearby that contain a lot of indigenous caves. And we went to two or three of them and just arranged the photograph in a number of different ways and came up with a design that we liked. And Liam took the photos. And then we photoshopped it a little bit to change the contrast and the look. And that's what we ended up using for the cover.
Well, I looked really closely at that photograph, because if this was supposedly the character in the story, I wanted to know at what point in the story was he depicted, because I looked especially at his hands. And I won't tell listeners why I would be looking at his hands, but I did look carefully at that photograph, which is actually you, as you said. And the title says, After the Virus, a Survivalist's Journal. Did you invent that word, survivalist?
I did, you know, and I had a number of people ask me about that. They sort of questioned me as though I was doing something wrong. And I said, well, you know, William Shakespeare invented 1,700 words that he added to the English language. I said, I can certainly, you know, do my share with one or two.
And you kind of give yourself permission to do that in the prologue. I thought that was cute. That was an interesting, the way you concluded your prologue. But I also was curious to notice the timing of this book, because you must have been writing on this long before our current pandemic.
Yes, I started in about 2014, and it was right around the time that both the Ebola virus and the Zika virus were in the news on a regular basis. And so that along with my interest in wilderness skills and my interest in indigenous peoples in the area all sort of fit together to make this story.
My guest is Chico City Councilman Scott Huber. He has come out with a novel called After the Virus. And I mentioned your prologue, Scott. So would you read your prologue for us?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. This journal was found in 11 PV on the dock of Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay, California, former United States of America, by recolonizers. It's one of the few surviving written journals of the year leading up to the catastrophic events of March 2034. While some scholars have questioned its authenticity, it's generally regarded to be a bona fide diary of so-called survivalists, and as such, sheds light on the anarchic response to the devastating death toll of the mutated Bundibugyo virus, BDBV, in the genus Ebola virus, family Filoviridae, order Monongaviralis. This reprinting is unedited and retains the journal's original colloquialisms, spelling, punctuation, errors, and omissions.
This is Scott Huber reading from the prologue of his novel, After the Virus. And at the end of your prologue, you say, well, this is the way he wrote it. So you may find some errors in here, but we're reprinting this journal as he wrote it. So the journal starts April 15th of the year 2033. And it's told in the first person. So I would like, as you read, I'm going to ask you to read now sure. part of just the first three paragraphs that Will writes on April 15th, 2033.
This is the journal detailing my experience after the virus. I'm not certain that there will be anyone left to read it, but if there is anybody remaining at the end of all this, if civilization survives, perhaps this diary will serve as an accounting of what transpired in the days immediately following the great wave of death and the collapse of the world as we knew it. I'm sitting here in a place I never thought I'd be, yet often imagined that I would. I'm overlooking a wide canyon of gray pines, blue oaks, and bay laurel, deerbrush, buckbrush, redbud, and coffeeberry. The chasm is framed by rock chimneys, rose-hued palisades, and an untold number of caves, like the one I'm sitting at the entrance of now. There are no man-made sounds, and birdsong surrounds me. But it is drowned out by the cacophony of memories of the last week, all that I've lost, and all the terrible things that I've done. This is the first chance I've had to stop and think about it, the first time I can remember that I'm not just reacting to a crisis that required an immediate life-or-death response. If I'd taken an extra moment to think about them, I'd likely be dead, like the 7 billion others.
This is Scott Huber reading from his second book, a novel, After the Virus. And you have your character say, all that I've lost and all the terrible things I've done. And we don't know, at this point in his journal, we don't know what those terrible things are. But boy, when I read them, I thought, I don't know if I like this guy.
Yeah, my family didn't know if they liked me very well after that part either. It kind of took them a while to realize that the things that he did in the beginning of the book were really because he cared, not because he was evil. And I think throughout the book, he shows his humanity often, although he has to make a lot of really tough choices throughout.
Yeah. Well, let's pick up the story when he says the final straw was the mutation of the Ebola virus.
Yes. The final straw was the mutation of the Ebola virus. It had languished in equatorial Africa for decades. Once it moved out of Africa, it changed in 100 different ways. Eventually, mosquitoes, fleas, and ticks became carriers. And strangely, there was speculation that a small percentage of humans carried and spread the disease without showing any signs of infection. The virus had increased in intensity as well, and there were no cures and no vaccines for these new strains. To catch it was a death sentence, and a messy one. Within hours of exposure, victims began to hemorrhage blood from their mouths, their nose, eyes, ears, through their pores, and from every other orifice. Anyone coming into contact with the blood would suffer the same fate within hours. It hadn't hit our region yet, but it seemed as though there was nothing that could stop it. That's when I started packing. I've always been something of a survivalist. I've been a hunter and a fisherman all my life. I was in the first wave of Army Delta Force troops to fight in the Tora Bora Mountains of Afghanistan in 2001, serving as an MOS 18B, where I did more killing than I care to think about. When I got back, I used my GI benefits to double major in botany and zoology and became a wildlife biologist. For recreation, I studied Native American cultures and immigrant history. Ishi, called the Last Wild Indian, had lived in the foothills just 30 miles east of my home until he was discovered in 1910. For 3 decades, he evaded human contact and was pursued by white Indian hunters in the extremely rugged wilderness of canyons, cliffs, and caves that now bear his name. I hunted and explored that area for years, and knew the location of many of the caves that he and the Yana tribe used for shelter and hiding, and I meant to go there to do the same. With the help of my wife, 17-year-old son, and 15-year-old daughter, I began caching supplies in the wilderness. That's when the roads were still open, and a loaded pickup truck was not yet the subject of scrutiny. Camping gear, food, water, medical supplies, tools, etc. I hid them all in those hills just in case of a collapse. I had no idea how soon it would come. No one did.
And this is the journal of a person that we get to know. The journalist's name is Will. And a lot of what he says, I'm sure, is knowledge that you have, like familiarity with the area, the wilderness there near Chico, where Ishi lived. And I also wondered, you may have majored in botany and zoology. Is that true, that you wanted to become a wildlife biologist?
I didn't. I was a geography major, but I kind of always wished that I had been a biology major or one of the zoology or botany. So those were sort of latent desires of mine. Geography is kind of nice in that it's an all-encompassing major. And so geography can take in all of those other fields. And so I dabbled in it quite a bit. And I actually worked as a wildlife biologist without ever having a degree in biology. Worked as a wildlife biologist for a couple of years in the mid-2000s.
Yeah, I could recognize that a lot of this that you describe is experience that you had. But I don't think you were you in the military? You described this person, the narrator, as saying, I was in the first wave of Army Delta Force troops. But I don't see how you could have had time for that, Scott. You did so many, you've had so many careers over, and you're not that old enough to have had all these careers.
Yes, I did not. And I'm actually too old to have served in the military in 2001. But that was something that I had to research, and I had to look into, you know, what's the designation for a class of personnel that would have been in on that battle in the Tora Bora Mountains in the first wave, the special forces. So it was kind of fun to research that and be able to come up with those titles.
So then your character, I don't want to give away how he lost the rest of his family, but he is alone now. When we pick up the journal, he says he had to pass through the small foothill community of Cohasset to go get his supplies that he'd stashed. So let's pick up. So all that was going on April 15th, this one day. So let's pick up his journal and the next day, April 16th, the year 2033.
Sure. End of a long, tiring day of moving supplies. Picking up this account where I left off. After concealing the truck, I took the backpack and the wheelbarrow I had brought, filled them with hastily chosen final supplies, and headed for the cache. To reach my stored supplies, I had to walk about a half a mile. The final 100 yards was impossible with the wheelbarrow, so I took the contents of the backpack, then made two more trips for the contents of the wheelbarrow. With the barrow empty, I removed the wheel, which I packed in the backpack. Then I buried the rest of the wheelbarrow under a thick patch of manzanita.
My guest is Scott Huber. We'll be back after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is author Scott Huber. His first book was a journal for naturalists, and he has now written a novel. And this novel takes place here in Northern California in the wilderness. And he is going to the trouble of hiding, he said, after concealing the truck, and then he had to hide the wheelbarrow. Why is he having to hide these things, Scott?
Well, he needs to completely shed everything behind him and the possibility that there will be people, other survivors of this catastrophe that want to invade his space or take his things or even kill him. And that ends up coming to pass. There actually ends up being a militia or a paramilitary that comes searching for any of the people that survived the original wave of the pandemic.
And that's what makes the novel so scary. We don't know, as we're reading along, we don't know when these, and you give them initials, the viral non-compromised immune, but maybe carriers.
Yeah, sure. So actually a term that is used by the military to describe these asymptomatic people is VNC, which stands for viral non-compromised. And anybody who lived through the Vietnam War would recognize the title of VC that was applied to the Viet Cong guerrillas. And, you know, the military loves initials. And so that just sort of fit with the story.
So we're reading along. We never know when he's going to be attacked. And they're not kidding. These are very dangerous people. But along the way, he has to survive. He has to eat. He has to clothe himself, shelter. And so I was fascinated by some of these things that you bring out because I think, well, yeah, Scott must have made flour out of cattails, for example. Have you done that?
I have, yeah, just about everything, all the different survival skills that Will brings into play in the book are things that I have done myself. And in a lot of cases, I did them, well, I've been doing them for years, but in many cases, I did them just to prove that Will would be able to do them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've been out in the woods for the last 6 months sort of replicating things he did just to make sure that what I was saying is possible.
Yeah, because sometimes if a novelist or a movie gets something not quite right that I happen to know about, then it takes me out of the story immediately. So I appreciate the fact that you did research this and you say, when you describe the cattails, you strap them to your back, carry them into the cave. I cut off the bottom 6 inches, set the bases out to dry. I will mince and then pulverize them into a fine flour, which I can use in primitive baking. And shortly after that, you look around and here's this huge Pacific rattlesnake sunning itself. And so I know, well, yep, that rattlesnake's going to be dinner. But I didn't have the qualms about that so much because...
Well, in a survival situation, virtually... Sorry?
Yeah. I would understand that Will would eat a rattlesnake and it probably tastes like chicken.
Essentially, in his situation, he'll eat just about anything. Anything that doesn't, you know, that won't poison him, he'll eat.
And for example, you mentioned pine tea, making tea out of pine needles. I thought, gosh, I never thought of that. So I Googled it and I thought, I'm going to try making some pine needle tea one of these days.
Yeah. Do you remember Yul Gibbons?
Yes.
From the 1970s?
Yes.
The old commercial, ever eat a pine tree? Many parts are edible. Well, it's very true. In fact, you mentioned cattails. Cattails are considered the Swiss Army knife of survival foods because you can eat every single part of them. And pine trees are much the same. There's a lot of different things. You can eat the buds. You can peel the bark off for the cambium. You can make tea out of the pine needles.
Well, you mentioned that.
There's just a lot to work with out
there. You mentioned removing pieces of bark to get to the cambium layer. And you say, which I strip with my knife and chew on the slightly turpentine tasting flesh. I would think that would be gummy. It seems like when I was a child, I remember chewing on some resin from a pine tree and it was pretty sticky. But you do describe using, you know, peeling off the bark and chewing on that. And then here is... Here are a couple of sentences about this time that Will writes in his journal. He's saying that the billions of people who have succumbed to the virus. I wonder why. Why me? I live now only to survive, like Ishii hiding in a cave. What will come next? Will I be the last human alive on Earth? Because he doesn't know. Your character who's writing this doesn't know if he'll be the last human alive on Earth. So he goes about making jerky out of trout, for example. Turkey, of course, that's good if he can get a turkey. And there are scary sounds like helicopters overhead that he has to avoid. And then he encounters this live human. He says, it was a live human, a child. I couldn't just run away. And so who was this child he discovered?
Yeah, I think, really the thing that softens Will and softens the story is this relationship that grows between Will and Hope, this 16-year-old girl that he rescues after her family has been slaughtered by this paramilitary group that's out, hunting down all the survivors. And it's a relationship that it starts very tentatively with her being very afraid of him. And before long, it just blossoms into a wonderful partnership where they help each other throughout the rest of the story.
Well, in addition to having to provide food for themselves, their clothes get worn out. And so you have them tanning hides. They eat the meat of a deer, for example, and then they tan the hides for something to wear. At one point, you have them come down with a fever. And how does he know what the fever is about?
Yeah, so actually, there are a couple of different fever scenes in the book. And because of this history now that they know that ticks and fleas and mosquitoes have all been identified as potential carriers of the disease, he sort of is really worried when she's bit by a tick and then he pulls the tick out and he pops it between his fingers. And then within a couple of days, she comes down with a fever and suddenly he's thinking, oh man, could this be a carrier? Could this be a tick that was carrying the Ebola virus? So she gets sick. And then within a couple of days, while she is sort of falling into this stupor of this fever, he gets sick too. And they're both sick and out of it for many days. Fortunately, they've put some supplies right next to them, which sustains them. But then she comes out of it first. She nurses him for a few days. And then finally, they both recover from it. And they discover that, no, it wasn't that. It wasn't the Ebola virus. It was Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which actually, you'd think Rocky Mountain spotted fever would only be in Rocky Mountains. But there are many cases of it in California. So I assured myself that it could be. And all the symptoms that they exhibit during this fever are all symptoms that are diagnostic of Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
My guest is Scott Huber. He has written a novel, After the Virus, a Survivalist Journal. And the story begins, I mentioned, on April 15th, the year 2033. And the prologue tells us that this journal was found on the docks of Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay. Now, at this point in the story, he's a long way from Alcatraz. I don't want to spoil the story for people who would be reading, and there are a lot of surprises in your book. But I would like you to read, Scott, when they get to July 4th. And they don't always know. They aren't always real sure of the date, but he realizes, okay, what is independence, July 4th, that he'd always celebrate as Independence Day? So would you read Will's journal entry for July 4th, the year 2033?
Yes. Assuming that I have the date correct, as I write this, I'm reminded of the Independence Day holiday, and how the country used to celebrate it, and how our family used to watch the fireworks shows at the county fairgrounds. Now, I know the true meaning of independence, and also of dependence. For the last 4 months, I've become completely independent of the collapsed society I left behind. And in the past week, I've been liberated of most of my man-made possessions. This pride in my ability to survive is bittersweet. The price of it was losing much of what I loved. But I also learned dependence. Dependence on every rock, plant, and animal that surrounds me, sustains me. I'm part of a complicated fabric that works together. Everything around me has a use, as a tool, as a weapon, as food, as security. What do I contribute to that fabric? Carbon dioxide I exhale is used by the trees to produce sugar and cellulose. My urine returns some minerals and moisture to the earth. My feces, too, provides nutrients. When I die, mammals, birds, insects, and other organisms will derive sustenance from my carrion. And then there's human dependence. I might have given up weeks ago if not for Hope. Not only because she needs me, but because I need her. Humans are social animals. Hope is my salvation. Tonight we celebrated the 4th of July by building a large fire among the rocks against the rock face and watching the shadows dance against the cliff.
This is Scott Huber reading from his novel, After the Virus, A Survivalist's Journal. And like I say, the story has many twists and turns. You never know what's going to happen on the next page. And there's no filler. It's all action, it's adventure, and sometimes it's hard to read, but I'm going to let the readers be surprised. So I'm going to finish up on the 4th of July in the year 2033, Scott, and the readers then can read into the year 2034. Thank you so much for telling us about your novel, Scott.
Thank you, Nancy. I really appreciate it.
My guest has been Scott Huber. His novel is After the Virus, A Survivalist Journal. After a break, I'll ask local children's book author Gail Darcy about her newest book. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Local children's book author Gail Darcy got a nursing degree from California State University, Chico. She lived and worked in Marysville, Sacramento, Sonoma, and Oroville, where she's lived since 2000. When a nursing job at Sonoma didn't work out, she entered the coffee business, first with a coffee cart, then with a coffee company and art gallery. It was hard work, but she found it a lot of fun. Her previous books have included The Boys from San Francisco, Coffee House Chronicles, and a series about a starfish. About a year after the November 8, 2018 campfire, she went to the burned ruins of paradise. This inspired Gail Darcy to write a story for children, Polly Pinecone. Gail Darcy, welcome.
Hi.
You know, I found something unique about your children's book, but I wanted to ask you first what you consider unusual or different about your children's book, Polly Pinecone.
While I don't exactly know what's unusual about it, that there was a definite reason for me to write it. That was, I was, I trying to kind of identify with the children that would have been traumatized by the whole fire situation. And I thought that it would be, that was my prime purpose in writing it, was to provide a story in which the children could then follow up and tell more about what happened to Polly. And at the same time, they would be telling their own story.
Yeah, because that's what I found unlike any children's story I've ever encountered. And that is, there is no ending. And yet, well, there is an ending, but let me read what you say on the very last page of Polly Pinecone. What happens next? Are Grady and Harry okay? Will they find Polly? Are the mom dead and children safe? And what about Toby? Please help us find out. Thank you. So I'm introducing characters. I'll give you a chance to tell who these characters are, but you don't say what happens. And I suspect you got this idea from reading to second graders in Yuba City.
Yes.
To end your story without an
yes.
ending. And what did you mean by that?
Well, when I read my series of Stanley Starfish and Stanley Star to second graders in Yuba City, I did that over a period of several years. And then the teacher of that particular class invited me back year after year. And the last year that she was going to retire after that, she suggested that the children in that class write the next story about Stanley. And so they composed their little stories and they did drawings. They gave them to me and I put them together in a book. And that is actually a delight. That was Stanley Star Goes Exploring. So that's how I got the idea that kids have ideas about the characters and that they can put themselves in a position or their imagination can go any which direction. So that's where I got the idea that perhaps the kids could benefit from having Polly as a main character and the persons that she was surrounded with, then they could take that and write their own story. And that would help them get through this.
Gail, we're accustomed to the creators of characters for children giving alliterative names. We're accustomed to Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, Bugs Bunny. So when I saw you had named your character Polly Pinecone, I thought, that's alliteration. But then I opened to the first page of your book to your dedication. And what does your dedication say, Gail?
Well, it said that the book is for the children, and of course that's who it was written for, and so that's the dedication. Plus, I have such fond memories of my Aunt Polly, my mother's sister, whose name was Viola, but they called her Polly. And she was a wonderful, wonderful woman, and she helped me a lot growing up.
So this main character of your book generates fond memories for you of your aunt named Polly.
That's correct.
Well, let's find out who Polly Pinecone is. Would you read the first page of your book, Gail?
Oh, golly, sure. Be glad to. My name is Polly. I am a young pinecone who lives on a branch in a tall ponderosa pine tree near the small town of Paradise. I am surrounded by many other magnificent pine trees growing on this little hillside. In my tree are many branches with older pine cones that sway back and forth with the gentle breezes. Small wild animals scamper beneath us, along with some children and a dog who play in the yard. This is a lovely place to live. Nature's beauty surrounds us. That's case one.
And so there's the first character. We meet the main character, Polly Pinecone. And then you have the illustrator has illustrated this very cute little animal clinging to the trunk of this pine tree. And who is this little character? Would you continue on your next page?
Oh, certainly. Okay. That one day, A small gray fuzzy animal with a bushy tail came scampering by my branch. "What is your name?" I called out. "Oh, hi, my name is Grady. I am a gray squirrel. What is your name?" Polly answered, "My name is Polly. I am a pinecone." And there's the squirrel.
So we meet the next character. Grady is a gray squirrel. And what does Polly say?
Well, let's see. Polly answered, "My name is Polly. I am a pinecone." And so the gray squirrel asks Polly, "If you're a pinecone, how come you do not have pine nuts for me to eat?" "Grady," the squirrel asks, "I am too young. My seeds are growing inside of me. I have to be about 2 or 3 years old before my seeds become pine nuts big enough to eat," Polly explained. You want me to go on?
Yeah. So Grady's not happy to hear that.
No, of course not.
Yeah, I'm young also, and I've been on my own for a few months. I have to rush around to find food. So this gives us a clue that this is the time of year when squirrels are really busy. And it happened, we don't know at this point in the story that there's a fire coming, but it happened to come in early November. So this is the time of year when squirrels are quite active. And Polly says, "Well, I wish I could feed you." And what does she want to help Grady do? Yeah, if you'll continue.
Okay. Let's see.
Polly says, "I wish
Polly
I could help
says,
feed
my
you.
Dream is to get fatter and bigger. I want to provide delicious pine nuts for you, some of the birds, and hopefully plant some so that they will grow more pine trees."
So Grady asks her another question. If birds eat the pine nuts, and on the facing page is what kind of bird clinging to the bark of the pine tree?
That's a hairy woodpecker, and his name is Harry.
So we meet the next character in the story, and you tell us that Harry is a white and black bird, and that's what they hear making these pounding noises on the tree. And you say he also eats insects. This is why he pounds holes in decaying wood where beetles and other bugs lay their eggs. So you introduce these characters and tell us a little bit about these animals, the pine cone and the gray squirrel and the bird. And you introduce these characters and you tell us a little bit about them, and things seem to be going fine. But then what happens?
I'm sorry, what?
And then in your story, you introduce some other characters in your story. So far, we've had a pine cone and little animals. But you also say there's a family that lives nearby. And who is the family?
Well, the family consists of a mother and a father and 4 children. And they also have a dog named Toby.
So when friends are visiting, they would smell these delicious smells coming out of the chimney. So that tells us there's a brick chimney is a part of this family's house. We don't know when we first read that, the role that this chimney would play later on. But what happened after days passed and autumn comes?
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
Days pass and autumn comes.
Oh, right. Okay.
And you have a picture of Grady. Busy. It looks like he's burying a nut in the ground.
Oh, right.
And he explained that, like all squirrels, he has to gather nuts and acorns for the winter. They bury them and dig them up when they need them in the cold winter months. But then one night, Polly was awakened by the wind blowing. And what is coming?
Well, the wind was blowing so extra fast and very strong. All the branches on Polly's ponderosa pine tree were swaying back and forth, back and forth. Polly hung on tightly. It was a real windstorm.
So the wind is blowing, but she doesn't get blown off. She hangs on to the tree. And then down below, there seems to be chaos and And the dad now is telling the children, get in the van now. And mother is shouting over and over, Toby, that's their dog's name, and shouting for Toby. And then what happens next?
Well, suddenly, Polly can see and feel gray powder stuff falling on and all around her. While still clinging to her branch, she calls out to Grady or to any other creature nearby. What's happening? What should I do? The sky is becoming darker and darker. Just then, bright yellow, red flames seem to be exploding in surrounding trees. Polly hears the mom screaming something, and then she jumps into the family's van just as it pulls out into a mass of other cars. Sirens are blaring. Fire, fire. Polly's paradise, her Ponderosa, her family, was on fire. Red hot flames crackled all around.
So this is children's book author Gail Darcy. She's reading from her book, Polly Pinecone. She's introduced the characters in this story, and everything seems to be going fine until suddenly there's a fire, there's chaos. And these characters then are affected, obviously, by the fire, including Polly. What happens to Polly?
Well, Polly's branch was on fire and being blown completely off the tree. She realized quickly that she was hot and would be burned up. It would be the end of her dream to grow up and share her pine nuts with Grady and Harry and to make another Ponderosa pine tree. What was Polly feeling? For an instant, she felt gladness for her friendship with Grady and Harry, love for her pine tree and all the other pine cones with hopes that they survived, appreciation for the wonderful human family that had lived below her. Crash, bang, crack. Polly could feel herself falling rapidly through a very dark space.
And then where does she land?
Then thump. She had landed in a bed of ashes. Somehow her burning branch had landed atop the family's fireplace chimney. She had come loose from the branch and had fallen into the soft bed of old dry ashes in the fireplace. There she lay, frightened and all alone. And then it seemed like a very long time passed until one day Polly heard a lot of noise. The noise grew louder. The noise sounded like a big machine that was coming closer and closer. Suddenly, someone or something scooped up the ashes from the fireplace, including Polly. They were dumped into the back of a big red truck.
So then we think, well, okay, there goes Polly in that big truck. But you say that what happened next was a miracle.
Yes, what happened next was a miracle. The back of the big red truck was overloaded, so the shovel full of charred fireplace ashes, along with Polly, fell off the back end of the big red truck just as it was driving off to a faraway dumping ground. Polly was so grateful. Maybe, just maybe, Polly thought to herself, my pine nuts are about large enough to share with my dear friends. But where are they? My friends, Grady and Harry, are they okay? I want to see them and spend time with them. I miss them. And what about the happy family? Where have they all gone? All that remains in their once lovely house is the big, tall fireplace chimney, the chimney that saved my life. I hope they come back, but where will they live? All I can say is stay right here where I am and hope that my friends will find me. I am one very lucky pine cone.
So then you say that that's the end for now. And I might add that when you went up to paradise yourself to look at what paradise looked like after the fire, you took a friend with you, and it sounds like your friend is commenting on this in the background. Who is that?
My friend is, hold on, I'll see about my friend.
No, Gail.
Yeah.
I'm just asking, didn't Motley accompany you up into
Motley is my dog. Okay. He's a Cocker Spaniel, and he accompanied me to paradise.
Okay, that's good. So you're inviting children now to write the end of this story, because I'm assuming that some of these children will have experienced the fire themselves and will have ideas, a lot of ideas about what happens to these characters that you introduce. Thank you so much, Gail, for sharing this story with us.
Well, you're very welcome. I am hoping that there is enough interest that I receive some of these children's stories. It's very difficult, as you can well imagine. The idea was that we would present the story to them in their classroom. But as you know, the classrooms are no longer. So my idea is then that perhaps the parents could present the story to the children, and then the children write the story and maybe draw something about their experiences.
Okay, well, thank you for that invitation, Gail. I'll remind listeners that my guest has been Gail Darcy, and her book for children is Polly Pinecone. Thanks, Gail.
Thank you very much, Nancy. Appreciate you.
And now, here's Richard Parker.
Let me tell you what I have grown extremely tired of. I am tired of turning on the television and watching one person after another get a needle poked into their arm. This coronavirus pandemic has provided us with quite a number of memorable bits of film, from long lines of cars lined up at testing sites to watching politicians and others parade around without masks one day and hearing about their checking into a hospital a few days later. But close-ups of people, one after the other, I tell you, getting poked with a needle and having a syringe full of stuff pumped into their muscle, well, a little of that goes a long way with me. Now, you may think I'm just being wimpy about something that isn't really that much of a big deal. And maybe you're right, at least to a point. And maybe it's a carryover from a childhood fear of getting shots. I actually recall, from whatever tender age I was at the time, having recoiled at the idea of going to the doctor and actually getting stabbed. It was just a needle and not a hunting knife or a saber, of course, and it was designed to do me good rather than evil, but still, damn it, it was getting stabbed. Think for just a minute about killing yourself. Not really, of course, just a thought experiment. Consider, given that the results are equally lethal, would you rather be shot in the chest with a pistol, or would you prefer being run through at the same location with a sword? I'll bet the majority of you are on my side. Give me the pistol every time. Well, there would only be one time, wouldn't there? It's true that Roman commanders and other ancients, in a fit of military or other embarrassment, are said to have done themselves in by falling on their swords. And maybe a number of them did, but I'd bet my place in the vaccine line that they'd have used pistols if they had had them. Well, one might bring up the medieval Japanese practice of seppuku or harikari. That's an example of voluntary fatal self-poking. And I guess this happened even after the arrival of firearms on those islands. All I can say is that this is also the military culture that endorsed kamikaze attacks. Well, I suppose I shouldn't be comparing getting a shot from a professional medical person with getting eviscerated by one's own or another's hand. I know I inflate matters sometimes. But the first shots that I actually remember were penicillin shots. And in case you haven't had one lately, the stuff is fairly thick and it requires a fairly fat needle. Now, it's not quite a samurai sword, sure, but it's enough to scare the bejesus out of a little kid and to produce a memory that haunts me still. This is Richard Parker.
And now, former Chico News and Review columnist Anthony Payton Porter tells us what he thinks about school standards.
School standards. Detailed school standards are a bad idea. Standards came from business. Did you know that? To make it easier to predict how we would do on a job and to get us into the most profitable cubicle. That's still what they're for. In normal relations between people, standards are irrelevant. Do you know how your friends did in school? Does it matter? How we divvy things up and name them has a lot to do with how we see the world and how we think. The law always lags behind people, sometimes by hundreds of years. When the government controls what everybody learns, what do you suppose will happen to social evolution? That's how the imposition of a dominant cultural view is oppressive, by assuming that no other skills or ways of looking at the universe are even worth knowing. That's how the government celebrates diversity. Families should be able to add subjects as we go. I vote for gardening. And then we choose what categories to skip, because families should decide what their children learn, not the government, so that we could substitute, say, ceramics for algebra. Think of refusing to testify. Standards can be useful for people to compare themselves with others, which we're going to do anyway. That's okay, but we've got to get standards out of the grubby hands of the fascists and educators who want to force our children to learn what they think is important, for the good of our children, of course. With standards, politicians decide the range of subjects taught and tested in schools. And then presumably students can specialize in whatever they want. That sounds all right, but here's a relevant quotation. If you give me the power to nominate, you can vote for whomever you please. Do you know who said that? Mussolini. So let families pick the standards for their children. Fancy dancing, cooking, yoga. Otherwise, standards are just, how good a worker will you be, child? And definitely backgammon. I'm Anthony Peyton Porter. This is a poem by Kenneth Rexroth called Discrimination. I don't mind the human race. I've got pretty used to them in these past 25 years. I don't mind if they sit next to me on streetcars or eat in the same restaurants, if it's not at the same table. However, I don't approve of a woman I respect dancing with one of them. I've tried asking them to my home without success. I shouldn't care to see my own sister marry one. Even if she loved him, think of the children. Their art is interesting, but certainly barbarous. I'm sure, if given a chance, they'd kill us all in our beds. And you must admit, they smell. That was Discrimination by Kenneth Rexroth. And I'm Anthony Porter.
I'd like to thank my first guest, Scott Huber, who wrote After the Virus, a Survivalist Journal, and children's book author Gail Darcy, who wrote Polly Pinecone.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.